Welcome to session 268, titled Men and Priesthood, Mormon Male Identity. We ask you to silence your cell phones. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. We encourage you also to purchase other Sunstone merchandise or to make a donation to Sunstone to help support these amazing events. Your donations keep the organization going. We need it. The session is 60 minutes long, including a Q&A, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework. About this presentation, here's an abstract for us. How does priesthood connect to personal and group identity for LDS men? How does it factor in their church activity and attendance or their gender and sexual identity? How crucial is priesthood ordination for Mormon boys as initiation into adulthood? How do men perceive equality and hierarchy in their priesthood experience? How does male priesthood relate to a sense of personal and group authority? These and similar questions will be examined in this session. A little bit about our presenter, Margaret Toscano, is Associate Professor of Classics and Comparative Studies at the University of Utah. She's published extensively on Mormon feminism and is a frequent presenter at the Sunstone Symposium. And, my two cents is that she is also an excellent cook. She seems to be excellent at everything that she does. And she is both my favorite and probably the best Mormon philologist in our history. So let's give her a round of applause.
So you should always pay your introducer to compliment you, right? But thank you, Bert, for that nice introduction. I should warn you right off that I'm not going to answer all of the questions that are in my abstract, although I am interested in them. And in fact, I have a question here for men that I'm going to pass it around at the end of my presentation, and wanting you to answer some questions that you could either send to me anonymously or email them to me, because this is really an ongoing project, and as I said, I don't have all the answers, but I do want to raise some good questions. So my paper today marks somewhat of a departure from topics I've emphasized in the past. Many of you know that I have been speaking and writing about women's right to priesthood for the last 34 years. My emphasis today on men and priesthood arises from an assignment to produce a chapter on this topic for a book to be published called The Rutledge Handbook of Mormonism and Gender. So I thought I better get a good start by giving a paper here to force myself. So while I have focused on women in the past, the very nature of the topic of priesthood means that I've also explored men's relationship to priesthood because the two are very intertwined. But still, I'm hoping to bring some new insights, if not today, in my chapter, which you can help me with. So it's very much in draft form. I'm trying to raise some interesting questions. And I think my paper is short enough that we should have some time for some interesting interaction. In our 1990 book, Strangers in Paradox, Paul and I dealt with the nature and purpose of priesthood, and in doing so, pushed against the Mormon tradition that only men have a right to priesthood, a male-centered view that arises in most religious systems, certainly not just Mormonism, whether they're Jewish, sex, or Christian, or Muslim. It is a view rooted in, and actually even in Eastern religions too, it's very strong, this idea of male authority in traditional religions. It is a view in Mormonism, of course, that's rooted in sacred texts, such as both the Old Testament notions there with the temple and the New Testament's presentation of Christ calling only male apostles. In the Doctrine and Covenants, the male ownership of priesthood is strongly asserted in such revelations as sections 84. Men's heirship to celestial glory is connected with priesthood in section 76. What I have highlighted in my past writing is that this scripture-based tradition of priesthood ownership by males was expanded by Joseph Smith to include women in his later years with the introduction of the temple endowment and the formation of the Female Relief Society of Nauvoo, and particularly in Joseph Smith's final discourses on the nature of the fullness of the priesthood. So in fact, I really think that he redefines a lot about priesthood that is now overlooked. In addition, I have shown how biblical and Mormon scriptures, I've been fighting pneumonia all summer, so hopefully my voice will hold out. In addition, I've shown how biblical and Mormon scriptures provide a basis for seeing women as recipients of priesthood power and offices. And there's actually a lot of work by Jewish and Christian feminist writers on all sorts of historical evidence for women having priesthood, not just in biblical texts, but also in Christian tradition. While there may seem a more natural connection between men and priesthood in Mormonism, because of the structure of the church and two centuries of theological writings, I want to interrogate that connection today as being natural. The central question of my presentation today has two sides. Why do men seek priesthood, and why have so many come to abandon this quest? Because of the organizational structure of the church, men are groomed early to accept the concept of priesthood and a priesthood ordination as part of their maturation as males, as a rite of passage, a status in the church community, and as a personal identity and spiritual goal for worthiness. It is something that is just a normal part of being male in the church. It's not something to question because it just is. Becoming a deacon, teacher, priest, and elder is presented and accepted as the preordained route to becoming a worthy man in the eyes of the Lord and the church. In talking to LDS women over the years about why they don't want priesthood, and I found that most don't, they often cite the strong connection between maleness and priesthood as God ordained. For such women, to desire priesthood is to reject their own womanhood. The long-standing rhetoric of church leaders that men have priesthood and women have motherhood has reinforced these feelings. It has taken a great deal of argument and logic over the last 30 years to show why this priesthood-motherhood dichotomy is false. And notably, church leaders in the last few years have mostly stopped using this argument. Women have also expressed an aversion to wanting priesthood ordination because they claim it is a burden and responsibility that they would not want to bear. It involves the judgment of others, well, where mistakes can be made and power can be abused. Others don't want to be part of a hierarchical system. Now, all the reasons for rejecting priesthood expressed by Mormon women are also concerns expressed by Mormon men, I have found. Some of these men even object to the model of maleness put forth by the church as too narrow and exclusive. Many have also expressed concerns about the negative implications of power and abuse sometimes associated with priesthood, as well as for the distaste for hierarchy. And yet, with all the problems, in talking to men, I have found that many have had very positive experiences in the church that make them feel that whatever problems exist are outweighed by the many good deeds they have both done and seen done by male priesthood holders who are trying to do the best they can. What I don't often hear as a stated concern about priesthood, but what I have observed is this, especially from those who have experienced a loss of faith. It can be expressed as a question. How can I continue to function as a priesthood holder if I no longer believe in the underlying spiritual power of priesthood, and if I no longer have faith in the truthfulness of the church? What if a sense of the magic is lost? If priesthood is essentially supposed to be a conduit of the supernatural, can I, and I'm in the voice of men here saying, can I in good conscience function in the church priesthood? Is it ethical to do so if I feel that I can still help people while being true to myself by not expressing belief? So I will address some of these concerns about priesthood, and I want to start with the verses of the revelation set forth in Doctrine and Covenants 1:21. Its most oft-quoted passages read as follows, that the rights of the priesthood are inseparably connected with the powers of heaven, and that the powers of heaven cannot be controlled nor handled only upon the principles of righteousness. That they may be conferred upon us, it is true, But when we undertake to cover our sins, or to gratify our pride, or vain ambition, or to exercise control or dominion or compulsion upon the souls of the children of men in any degree of unrighteousness, behold, the heavens withdraw themselves, the Spirit of the Lord is grieved, and when it is withdrawn, amen to the priesthood or the authority of that man. Now this verse is most often cited to critique priesthood power abuses. But that's not going to be my focus here today. There's been a lot written on that. Rather, I wish to dwell on the juxtaposition in these verses of two aspects of priesthood, the inner aspect and the outer. The inner is referenced as the powers of heaven, or the Spirit of the Lord. The outer is referred to as the rights of the priesthood, or the authority of that man. Implied in these verses are a series of dynamic relationships established by the reception of the priesthood. These relationships include, but may not be limited to, the fluid relationships between first, the priest and the community served; second, the priest and God; third, the physical world and the spiritual world, where an action in one realm may trigger a response in the other; and fourth, the relationship between the inner self and the outer self, in a sense maybe the public and private person. All of these relationships may be ruptured or destroyed by the abuse of priesthood authority whenever it is used to gratify our pride, our vain ambition, or to exercise control or dominion or compulsion upon the souls of the children of men. And I think it's interesting here that, in a sense, even if you're thinking of the inner aspect of your relationship to yourself, if you're hypocritical or dishonest, could that also rupture, I think it can, that kind of inner integrity? Because the abuses of priesthood are obvious to Sunstone audiences, I decided to dwell here on the benefits of priesthood, and I want you all in the audience, both men and women, to think about what these have meant in your lives, and I'm not trying to eliminate the negative aspect, but I want us to think about the positive too. I will start with the relationship between the priest and the community served, because this is the arena in which priesthood benefits are most obvious. There is a way in which priesthood structure sets up expectations for community service, which facilitates individual acts of giving assistance and showing compassion. Thus, priesthood can create systemic good that spreads beyond an individual. It also moves beyond personal services because its very structure facilitates the rallying of group effort to address problems that surpass the ability or competence of any one individual. Helping a neighbor move, provide food and services to a grieving family, lining up sandbags to diminish the damage of a flood, the list goes on to include soup kitchens, raising funds for medical treatment, establishing endowments and scholarships, the storage of food and other necessaries to assist the poor, the disabled, or the victims of natural disaster. And I think Mormons are very good at those. All of these efforts can be accomplished without priesthood, of course, in secular organizations. But the involvement of priesthood insinuates into the acts of charity a sense of divine mandate, not only to help each other in times of need, but to establish a community based not on individual aggrandizement, but on cooperation and mutual concern and compassion. This kind of structure not only encourages men to give physical assistance, but also spiritual and emotional assistance in the form of forgiveness and repentance, faith and hope, and a number of other intangibles that are easy to dismiss from a purely materialistic perspective. Of course, spiritual posturing by priests is a well-documented form of abuse, but there are many examples of spiritual and psychological aid given to those who bear the burden of self-loathing for wrongs done, failures endured, and sins committed. A priesthood structure can also facilitate brotherhood. Some water here. Brotherhood and positive relationships among men who tend not to form book groups. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Of course, mutual interest in sports, gambling, but guns, computer games, and the outdoors can also bring about male bonding. A priesthood structure, however, can facilitate brotherhood not based on common interests solely of a material nature, but of a spiritual and ethical nature that are linked to higher purposes among men who might not share common interests. In such a priesthood community, one might find both hunters and hymn writers, both soccer enthusiasts and statisticians, filmmakers and fishermen. Such a priesthood structure calls upon a broad base of interests that can benefit the community it serves, with a broad range of talents, music, law, finance, etc., which also encourage personal growth and development. This brings to mind that a priesthood structure facilitates such personal growth by presenting young men with rituals that demark their passage into maturity. And there are many examples of this, of course, but we shouldn't forget the mission experience, that it is such a rite of passage that cannot be underrated for its effectiveness in this regard. Now, I know it's true that some have very negative mission experiences, but still, missions continue to serve as a potent program for helping young men to accept responsibility for others, not just in the physical sense, but in a broader spiritual one, too. Though it is now common to raise issues of priesthood abuse, it must not be forgotten that the church's priesthood structure has for generations provided strong role models for maturing young males. Even for those with good fathers, other male role models help boys explore their many talents and learn valuable lessons. And I'm sure, you know, I'd like later, if any of you have examples of some of these things that might be helpful. The male-centered Mormon priesthood is obviously not inclusive and has thus denied its benefits to females and to gay men once they come out of the closet, and to transgender folk. Not surprisingly, the same priesthood structure that encourages male bonding has been unaccepting of both the feminine and of the natural attraction of male to male, or very suspicious of that, right? Historically, this priesthood structure has exhibited extreme fear and hostility to both. These serious flaws in its current manifestation, I do not think are necessary features of priesthood because they infect the authority structures of other organizations, both sacred and secular. They are not essential features of the nature, purpose, and exercise of priesthood in LDS communities. I think they're derivatives of fear and patriarchal tradition that encourage pride, ambition, control, and compulsion, the very things that the Doctrine and Covenants warns against, right? Which are the antitheses of the love that is the root of priesthood power that flows from God that could be extended to both women and gays without impairing its homosocial benefits. In fact, I know of wards and stakes who deal compassionately with LGBTQ members. I trust the goodness of most of the saints when general policies, church policies, don't set up obstacles for this. Unfortunately, we have some of those in place right now. Some raise the concern that if women are included in priesthood, Mormons will lose both the benefits of brotherhood in the priesthood and separate sisterhood in the Relief Society. It is also a concern that if women are ordained to priesthood and exercise it separately, they would nevertheless remain subordinate to the male priesthood. These are very valid concerns, but I don't think they're necessary elements of priesthood or an extension of priesthood to women. Again, I think they're impositions of outmoded patriarchy. I see the possibility of a Mormon priesthood system that is inclusive of men, women, gays, lesbians, and the transgendered, and that has the benefits of both brotherhood and sisterhood with productive interaction among all these individuals. And I think it's especially crucial for the equality of women that they particularly, I hope they are finally ordained, right, will participate in every priesthood council of the church from the first presidency on down. Such participation does not negate the productive potentiality of separate male and female organizations that would be maybe on the more on the margins that work within the larger priesthood structure. There could be separate creative dynamics that operate in men's and women's organization that can encourage various types of growth, development, and relationships. Most transgender individuals identify as either male or female, With compassion, the priesthood structure I envisioned could pose no problem for embracing them. I should add here, too, that I think it's really interesting that there have been some studies that show that of sort of the organized Christian or even most religions in America, that the LDS Church has one of the highest participation rates of men. And so some have wondered, if you did have a more inclusive priesthood body, would that somehow drive some of the men out? You know, I don't know if we can make comparison with professions where they were traditionally female, and then if they open up to have men and women, do the men lose interest? But I think that's an interesting question to think about with Mormon priesthood. You know, is it so involved with sort of male identity that that is something that men see as special, and, you know, how can that be dealt with? The benefits of the current male-centered Mormon priesthood structure on LDS families has been highly touted by the church for generations. Though this system encourages male domination, it has also encouraged Mormon men to be faithful husbands and responsible fathers. Again, there are many examples of abuse. The church has not dealt fully with the problem of spousal abuse or other things, but there is an ideal out there. These benefits are especially helpful in those cultures where they work to ameliorate and neutralize machismo attitudes and abuses. Although, I don't know, again, could we say that maybe there's a sort of subtle kind of maleness in U.S. culture that has a similar effect? The church has recently emphasized the priesthood partnership of a husband and wife and their families, but its continued denial of male and female priesthood equality in the larger church subverts this notion of equality in the domestic arena. Nevertheless, Mormon couples, especially younger ones, I think, sincerely work toward the goal of true priesthood equality in the family setting, which demonstrates, I think, a model that could work in the greater church organization. Complicating the relationships of the priest and the community and the priest and the family is the relationship of the priest to God. The most obvious element of this relationship is the status a priestly office provides. And that's actually connected to the church as well, though. But it gives a sense of personal identity, I think, especially when it is perceived as a conduit through which the Spirit of God flows to members of the priest's family and community, giving a special, you know, calling that, again, is connected to identity. Of course, this status, again, can be abused. And I keep repeating that because I don't want to, you know, understate that. To gratify pride, vain ambition, exercise control, dominion, or compulsion. On the other hand, priesthood authority and status can work positively to encourage confidence both in the priest himself and in those called to sustain the priest in sacred functions and in ecclesiastical office that authorizes an individual to accomplish ends that would be out of reach absent that office. I think of individuals who are very reticent and don't have a sense of kind of personal authority. There is a positive element of authority that comes to them through the priesthood. The outward office provides otherwise unavailable opportunities for the priest to act without absent the office. And again, it's going to have both an inner and this outer dimension. It, even though it's personal, it has an outer church dimension as well as an inward one. The inward aspect of priesthood comes from the claim that the priest is linked to the divine and therefore is entitled to a charisma or supernatural power that guides the priest even in his most mundane duties, thus encouraging others to yield to the priest an allegiance they might withhold from a secular authority. It is belief in the charismatic dimension of priesthood that encourages the priest to do the will of God and his followers to bring about good through the priest's leadership. It is the charismatic dimension of priesthood that illuminates it as a means of facilitating spiritual transformation and redemption. I don't think this is emphasized in the church, but I think that's inherent in the scriptural notion of priesthood. A transformation that affects both the priest and those to whom the priest ministers. If the essence of priesthood is the power or spirit of God, then a priesthood structure should harness this power to achieve spiritual and righteous ends. The kind of transformation I am talking about is a subtle development that works toward patience, love, acceptance, forgiveness, gratitude, and the desire to help the poor and the oppressed. It's interesting that 121 actually goes back and stresses some of these, but that's how the priesthood should work. This kind of priesthood work not only benefits the community and family, it spiritually magnifies the priest. The same process can occur in a strictly secular context as with teachers who are enlarged by their service to their students, both in terms of personal growth, knowledge, and wisdom. But in the sacred context of a priestly community, the emphasis shifts from measurable good to less tangible good sometimes, such as compassion and insight. This difference illuminates the effect of priesthood on the inner and outer self and on the physical and spiritual realms. Now, the inner self and the spiritual world are not necessarily appreciated by those committed to physicalism, a worldview that privileges body over mind, rational over intuitive, and that sees science not merely as a methodology for gathering facts about the material world, but as a worldview that is the only way to see the true nature of reality. But still, I think for many of us, that other realm can be important. Now, such a lack of appreciation for this kind of inner world can arise on two assumptions. Either the reality is only physical, or that success is only in what is measurable in material terms. And I think, unfortunately, even in the church, that emphasis on the material terms, like you see in the statistics for missions, is often emphasized. This lack of appreciation of the spiritual is aided and abetted by intolerant, fundamentalist, literalist religions that provide good reasons for rejection of priesthood, either in the form of ecclesiastical structures or charismatic spirituality. Too many of the most certain and vocal Christians have not promoted the love, hope, and charity of the New Testament, but rather a virulent, narrow-minded, and intolerant pseudo-Christianity, in my view, as exemplified by such self-identified Catholics and Protestants as Paul Ryan and Jeff Sessions. Individuals who have accelerated the exodus of honest seekers and believers out of the arms of the teachings of Jesus. I had to get that in. It is hard enough to believe in the magic of a supernatural order and its occasional and anecdotal intrusions into the material world of ordinary people, even without the grinding, abusive language and actions of such men and women, too. Two. Belief in the divine is fragile and cannot be expected to survive easily the onslaught of narrow-minded heretics. I'm calling them heretics. Hence the warning that the rights of the priesthood are inseparably connected with the powers of heaven and cannot be controlled or handled only upon the principles of righteousness. Even for an individual who has seen God in the face, as claimed by Joseph Smith, it can be more than a challenge to avoid the temptations of abusing priesthood authority. It is nevertheless astonishing that such a person called of God, tempted by self-interest and obviously flawed, could have the personal self-awareness, insight, and wisdom to produce the verses of DNC section 121 and explore the potentials for evil inherent in the gifts of God. No power or influence can or ought to be maintained by the virtue of the priesthood. Only by persuasion, by long-suffering, by gentleness and meekness, and by love unfeigned, by kindness and pure knowledge, which shall greatly enlarge the soul without hypocrisy and without guile. Amazing language. This is a declaration against self-interest and against narcissism, and serves as an example of the effect of the powers of transformation that true priesthood could have. The transformation effected here is not mechanistic. It is neither certain. Is achieved by winding paths of ups and downs and digressions. It cannot be plotted. It cannot serve as a proof against self-doubt and depression and even existential doubt about the existence of the divine and supernatural order. Hence, Joseph Smith's opening question at the outset of section 121, O God, where art thou? Where is the pavilion that covers thy hiding place? Hence, too, the cry of Jesus from the cross, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Those of you who have agreed with my positive assessments of priesthood, I may have lost by putting Joseph Smith in a positive light. At the outset of the Mormon movement, Joseph Smith was told that he would be known for good and evil. I here assert the positive elements of Joseph Smith's ministry because it is easy now to think only of the bad. I am asserting that we should not reject what is good simply because it is not perfect. Should we reject the good of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson because of the evil of their slavery? Well, maybe we could argue that. Some may think we should. We do this, I think. We reject, you know, when we see flaws, we tend to want to reject the whole thing, right? Because we want to disassociate ourselves with evil, which is very understandable. But it is wrong in doing so to disassociate ourselves with the good done by imperfect people. I mean, I think perfectionism in the church is a problem today. So how do we work with ours and others' imperfections? Ironically, this narrow-minded approach reinforces the dogmatism, certainty, and intolerance we find reprehensible in fundamentalist religions. This approach is predicated on the false assumption that we cannot find the spiritual except in what is perfect, but that denies the heart of Christianity, which is the power to transform water into wine, symbolic of the transformation of the imperfect by spiritual means. And I can hear some of you saying, we would be glad to do that if only the leaders would be willing to accept this. And I agree with you on that. That is a central problem in Mormon and Mormonism and Mormon priesthood concepts right now. But this view that, you know, we can transform the ordinary, the view where we question that, I kind of lost my place there. This view assumes that if the magic of the power of God does not work all the time, it doesn't work at all. It is a mechanistic and materialistic view that misperceives the workings of the holy, insisting again on certainty when the basis of religion is trust in God and hope in goodness, which I think is hard. And I say that next. For myself, it is easy to be skeptical, to believe the powers of heaven are not real at all. I understand why people abandon faith, religion, and priesthood. There are plenty of reasons for this. But I ask myself why I don't. Why I don't abandon completely the belief in priesthood. And believe me, I'm very skeptical about the LDS Church. But why don't I abandon completely the belief in priesthood as supernatural once and for all, especially when I've actually tried to do so? Why do I yet cling to the hope that there is something, some grace, some power at work in the soul, in the relationship of priest to community, to family, to self, and to the gods? I suppose it is because I have experienced something of the spiritual world, something undemonstrable, unprovable, unbelievable, and yet undeniable. I have seen this lifelong struggle with faith and doubt in my husband. Paul and I will celebrate our 40th wedding anniversary in September. But we met 7 years earlier in 1971 through my first husband, Guy. We were all students at BYU, and we're all into Mormon history and theology. I met Mike Quinn during that same period. We were the product of the idealistic 60s, which in Mormon terms meant that we wanted to build Zion, a classless community of equality and spirituality. In 1972, I moved into Paul's BYU ward. He was the best example I had ever seen of a faithful priesthood holder. He exhibited both charisma and the dutiful execution of his priesthood responsibilities. He perfectly balanced the rights and powers of the priesthood. When Paul taught Sunday school lessons or gave speeches in our ward estate, the spirit was palpable in the room, not just to me, who was falling in love with him, but to men in our ward estate too. Paul's favorite job at that time was helping freshman Aaronic priesthood holders prepare for their missions by teaching them the gospel. Decades later, some of these same men told me that it was because of Paul that they were converted to Christ's gospel and wanted to go on a mission. While some of Paul's priesthood leaders appreciated his dedication and spirituality, others saw him as an upstart who didn't know his proper place. Paul got in trouble at BYU at this time for preaching grace and criticizing a work-centered, judgmental, and perfection-based approach to religion in the church. It was at this time that Paul also began to publicly criticize church leaders for their corporate materialism and hierarchical emphasis of priesthood. It was a slow process of disillusionment. Paul was not always the angry apostate. Like others, Paul felt at first that if he patiently worked in the church, changes would happen. Maybe he would be given a high office that would allow him to facilitate these changes. I remember when Paul began to see this desire for office for change as ambition, and he decided to give it all up and speak publicly, more publicly than he had. So he joined me at Sunstone. It is ironic that when Paul and I got married, I was expecting the faithful priesthood-holding husband who would make sure we held family home evening and had daily prayer. But he was too disillusioned for that, and eventually so was I. I don't regret our journey out of the LDS church. I'm glad we made it together and that we have stuck together. It has been a transforming experience in many ways. Neither Paul nor I is as nice as we used to be. But our souls have expanded and maybe also contracted sometimes too, but that's kind of the breathing in and out, right? Paul didn't know that I was going to add this tribute to him at the end of my paper, but as I was exploring my ideas, I did ask him to think back on what the priesthood meant to him in 1972 when I was in his BYU ward. And I said, I know you'll start with denial so that you never did anything good. But you can't fool me. I've known you too long. I was there after all. Why was the priesthood so palpably powerful for you? And I finally got him talking. It started with his spiritual allegiance to Jesus Christ. The message of Christ's gospel was a visceral thing to him. Christ comes down to us so that we can go up to him. Christ's love wipes away our sins and burdens like blowing dust off a table. Christ's grace is sufficient to help us endure our sufferings. Paul admitted, I felt like I was on the Lord's errand. I was called by him to mediate the gospel to my generation. It wasn't as though I felt that everything I did was right, but I had a sense of confidence that I would be guided to do and say what was needed. His grace would make it work. My priesthood was meaningful to me because I wanted to be an instrument for Christ, and I knew the power was with me. Paul was actually more eloquent than this, but this was what my notes had. On one level, thinking back on this period makes me feel sad. There was a real loss for Paul and the church. This made me realize some of the positive benefits of institutional priesthood. Without a structure, there is not a venue or context to use priesthood to the same extent as he used it back in those days. On the other hand, Paul could never fulfill his mission as a prophet in exile, calling people to repentance, if he were still in the church priesthood structure. Grumpy old prophets sit alone in caves, or in Paul's case, in front of the TV in our bedroom, looking at the news, which these days could inspire anyone toward prophetic declamation. Paul always denies that he still believes in Christ and the supernatural, but he can't help himself. It is in the blood and bones once it is upon a person. Being God's priest is to swear personal allegiance to him to further his work of doing good and redeeming this world, however and whenever possible, no matter how small the work. This priesthood is without father or mother. It is not part of a church structure, but it can be found in all religions. And it cannot be taken, and even in the secular world, I believe. And it cannot be taken away by church leaders. It is the power of God that blows where it wants from the eternal Father and Mother of heaven and earth. But it is given to all who reach out and up for it, who want to use it for good. Even when our motives are not pure, and I think even if we don't believe, and in our imperfections, perhaps even more then, this priesthood power will bless others. Thank you very much. We have like 20 minutes, don't we?
Yeah.
You can.
Mm-hmm. And just speak in the mic, please, for the recording.
And before I forget, I'm going to hand these out. And I really, so these are questions that are related to, on this questionnaire, that are related to a lot of the issues I brought up. And I'm not a social scientist. I'm very much a humanities professor. But still, I would love to have some of you take this sheet, and I'll distribute it at the end to think about, you know, how you think about priesthood and the good and bad that you've perceived in it. So I should be talking to the microphone, but I have allowed you your voice.
Wow, that's really, really good.
Bill, thank you.
And it, as it emerges into the book, it'll be wonderful, I'm sure. The inner and outer sense, in my impression, and correct me if I'm wrong, so the Greek word for priesthood having to do very related to the word hierarchy seems to be the, hierarchy.
Yeah, say it for the audience.
Yeah, hierarchy.
Yeah, I mean, our word hierarchy comes from the Greek, and it's interesting that that
archeros,
word...
Archeros would be the...
hieros is the... It's actually, that's the holy or the...
The high priest.
Right, but I'm saying that the root of that word is actually holy, and then the ark has to do with the...
Power.
The power, yeah.
So with respect to inner priesthood, what I feel, or what I sense, is that, the Baptist notion of the priesthood of all believers, this concept that every member of the church holds the priesthood, and in the sense where women for 120 years... anointed and blessed each other and others and children and have this shared power, and we continue to do this in the temple. So there's this inner power that comes from this ability, and to use the hands in that case, very powerful. But the other part, the hierarchy part of this thing, the outer sense, Mormon priesthood is very much about the hierarchy.
I know.
Prophet on down.
So.
And it creates an impossible situation with respect to the role of women in that hierarchy. I have seen my wife, when she was Relief Society president, and I've seen other Relief Society presidents that I wish I were in the Relief Society, because they had power by virtue of this something that came from God into their roles. And I think we fail to understand that that's a temporary thing. That's a calling-based thing. And it should never be a persistent, rigid hierarchy of privilege coming through the mail. So how will... I mean, this paper really does justice to something that I need to ponder about, this idea that it sanctifies... The priesthood sanctifies this service. I really appreciate it, but I'd like you to address
that. Troubling. I agree.
How you address the hierarchy.
Yeah, in my longer paper, I'm going to go back to this, but Mark, I like a lot of the things that you said. I mean, first of all, it's really interesting, when I started wondering about women in priesthood, I read everything that Joseph Smith had ever written about priesthood, and I'm convinced that he believed in the priesthood of all believers. There are several statements, because he believed that essentially priesthood is the power of God. And like I said at the end, it's controlled by God, not by us. It flows where, it's the Spirit of God that flows. So that everybody that receives that has an element of priesthood. I think he believed that. So then the natural question after that, and you're right, it's not just women, it's children. It's anybody in any place. And again, I think even if you don't believe in God, I think if your heart... If you want to help people and you reach out, I think, as a believer, I think you have the Spirit of God. So then the natural question is, well, if that's what the priesthood is, why the hell do we even care about the structure? And in a sense, and maybe that was my missing piece that I didn't state, that's kind of the beginning of my question, which also we deal with in Strangers in Paradox. Because, if it's the spiritual thing that really matters, why have the structure? And so part of what I'm arguing here is that the structure allows things that if you're the grumpy old prophet and you're by yourself in the house, then, you can't use it. On the other hand, it inevitably goes to hierarchy. And by the way, hieros in Greek means holy. And arche has to do with rule. It should be the rule of holiness, not the rule of top down. I mean... Again, Paul and I, strangers, explore possibilities. I mean, and of course, I think just getting women in there would help the whole thing. But if you, and not that women don't make mistakes, believe me, you can have women who abuse power, and they do all the time. But what I'm saying is, if it breaks down the current hierarchy where you had councils of common consent rather than top-down leadership, I think it could be done, but there's a resistance because now it's like, this is the way it's always been and we're not going to change it, right? But I agree, it has to be rethought. You can't have a righteous priesthood organization if it's hierarchical. So We can revision it. I just think there's a resistance to do so. There are a lot of creative ways we could do it. Yeah, thank you, Mark. Yeah.
Yes, you had made reference to the teaching that motherhood is the female equivalent to the male priesthood. Now, I've never seen any scriptural basis for such a thing, and I was wondering if you knew about the history behind that tenet, how did it get started?
And actually, I just finally kind of traced this down with the help of my friend Catherine. Is that the last name?
Schertz.
Catherine Schertz, who's been a couple of people who've been working on both on. Suddenly my mind's going to go blank about everything. So you have John Widtsoe, his wife, and she was influenced by Brigham Young's daughter. What is her name? Susanna Van Gates, right?
Yeah.
She was really, because she believed very strongly in female power, and at the time that, so I'm going to give another paper to ordained women, where I talk about what happened. The women who were ordained under Joseph Smith firmly believed that they had priesthood, that they should use it in the church, and that the Relief Society was a female organization. Between 1892 and 1922 especially, the church leaders really forced them to deny all of that connection. It's a really troubling aspect of history. But in that point, Susie Young Gates began to try to develop a kind of female-empowered thing, and she said, well, maybe it's motherhood that is our thing. And then John Widtsoe, in his famous book about priesthood, that was when it really first started, of, oh, women have motherhood. And it was kind of like, oh, you women who thought you had priesthood under Joseph Smith, your consolation is you have motherhood. And then it started, and it got stronger and stronger. But because people like myself and Sonia Farnsworth and others have said, look, there's no scriptural or any basis for this, and besides, and I won't get into it now, but logically it just doesn't hold up. Men have fatherhood, women have motherhood, they both have priesthood. And the church has kind of backed down on that rhetoric a little bit. Of course, they're still insisting that women shouldn't have keys or offices. But yeah, it's a really interesting history to see how these things develop.
Very, very interesting. You suggested that you wondered if giving the women the priesthood would cause some of the men to kind of fade away. And you might have a good case study in the Community of Christ. For 33 years now, we've had women in the priesthood. My guess would be you'd find that there is some drifting away. It does seem like we have an awful large number of women pastors. We use kind of a prestigious job in that community. I don't know if I'm right or not, but I think it'd be a good study. Secondly, I think we looked at the American political system. It seems to me, with a little bit of evidence we have so far, that more women in Congress, both houses, and in state legislatures, you have more focus on issues that men tend to ignore or not do as well at, such as child care, health care, welfare, since 80-some% of adult males are adult welfare, poor people are women, and more of a dovish foreign policy and so forth. I think that the U.S. government would be a lot better off, and of course I think that any church would be better off.
Thank you, Bill. Bill's in the Community of Christ, and they're a wonderful example for how priesthood can be more communitarian. So, I mean, that's a great role model to follow, and I think also Bill, that I think it's really interesting that the Community of Christ did not use the sort of history of Joseph Smith that I've been, you know, promoting to ordain women, but really because it was the right thing to do and inspired by God.
Hardly aware of that.
Thanks, Margaret, for your presentation. My question is, do you think it would be right or even effective for those who have the institutional privilege of priesthood to deny themselves of that on behalf of those others who are denied priesthood? I'm thinking of Thoreau, who said, if anyone is imprisoned unjustly, I also will be in prison?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think a hard one to answer. I mean, on one level, it connects to the broader question of, if you're disillusioned and upset about the church, should you leave as protest or stay and try to make it better, right? And I don't know, I'd like to hear what some other people have to say. I don't feel like I have the right answer to this. For me, it's very personal. In terms of whether it would work, I think you'd have, if it were really going to work on an institutional basis, I mean, it's one thing to do it as a personal protest because you ethically feel it's the right thing to do. And to me, that's a matter of personal conscience. But whether or not it's going to be an effective way to change the church, I think you have to have a large group effort. I mean, let's face it, if the women said, you know, kind of like in the Greek play, Lysistrata, you know, we're not going to cooperate. Yeah, let's not give any sex to any of the men unless they agree to ordain them to the priesthood. You know, I don't know how effective would this be.
It's very effective.
Very effective. You know, maybe just even, I don't know, whatever you were going to withhold. But if one woman does it, it's not going to change the system. She may feel ethically good about that, but I think because something is going to be a social movement, you have to get a lot of, you have to get everybody to join you. So, you know, Lysistrata tried to see if she could lock them all in the citadel of Athens so that they wouldn't be escaping secretly to have sex with her husbands down in the woods, right? So, yeah, but you have it. I think, you know, it's a hard question, but thanks for raising it. Yes.
So, kind of based on what you said, I get the impression that, like, one of the main purposes that priesthood currently serves, and specifically the exclusivity of it to men serves, is kind of like a structure for men to sort of, like, reject certain societal, like, toxic ideas of masculinity without feeling like they're rejecting manhood in general. And do you feel like there's a good way to, like, still serve that purpose without maintaining the exclusivity and, like, of it?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because actually I think it can go both ways. I mean, I think you could argue that right now in the church, there may be certain toxic elements of maleness in America or other countries that the church has tried to remove itself from. But let's face it, there's also a kind of male privilege and power that is absolutely supported by the church that I think, you know, and I don't want to blame anybody, but, you know, even if you're not thinking that you're buying into that, I think that there's a way in which it works toward that, right?
Like, and it's a band-aid. It's not a solution. It's a
yeah, and so, I mean, for example, I think it's really interesting that I observe this in my students at the University of Utah. I think that young Mormon men that I see often have a lot more confidence in their opinions and kind of to do things. The women are sometimes, that's not always true, right? But I think that, again, even if you're not thinking that you're buying into a toxic system, and this has a good and bad side. I mean, there is that sort of confidence in the self and the idea that I can be a leader, I can do things. It can be good, right? But it can also, there's a toxic cell element. So I don't know, back to your question, are you going to lose the good if you...
Can you keep that? And lose
or even the idea, and I was trying to explore, like, I honestly believe that there can be something very powerful about brotherhood or sisterhood. And that's why, you know, in my re-envisioning of the Mormon priesthood, I think, well, in all the leading, you know, in the first presidency of the 12, all of the state presidencies, I want both men and women, because if you don't have shared leadership, then you don't have equality. But I don't want to get rid of the good elements of sisterhood. I mean, I like going to feminist girls camp or whatever, or, you know, and, you know, Paul has some good friends, male friends that, you know, they have breakfast that I don't go and try to join them. I think that's really positive. So how do you maintain, you know, how can you have both of that? And maybe the same is true with, and maybe I'm not answering your question right, but, you know, how do you, I think this is always a problem, which goes to my little section on imperfection and perfection. I think that we make the mistake sometimes of thinking that, you know, we think about, we want things to be pure and only good, right? Where it has nothing you know, no negative in it. And I just don't know if you can have that. So, but how do you increase the goodness of it and kind of play down whatever can be negative without losing? And I think that's even true with activity for men. You know, I want to encourage the idea that men feel like there's a special place for them. That's fine as long as it's not at the expense of others. So I don't think I've answered your question very well, but I'm struggling to do it anyway. But it's a good question. Thank you for raising it. Yeah.
Did we need to pass out that survey?
Oh, yeah, maybe we should do that. How much time? Oh, we have 5 minutes. Yeah. Anyone who wants to take it, and, you know, men, women, I don't care. Or if you want to email me, margaret.toscano@utah.edu. Go ahead.
So with Relief Society, like Relief Society,
whoever wants one, have them raise your hands, because everyone may not want it, and I don't have enough for everybody, okay, Bert?
Sure.
So pass it around if you don't think you're going to answer it. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so Relief Society used to be an independent organization. They used to choose their own leaders, they used to admit their own members, they used to, you know, raise their own funds, have their own fundraisers, right, have their own magazines, write their own lessons, so on and so forth, until Correlation came along, mm-hmm. my understanding.
That's true.
And also, 19th century, they used to, you know, perform their own ordinances. Do you think if that was intact, that we wouldn't be having this conversation, that maybe the ordained women movement wouldn't have happened if really society, you know, maintains independence and was continually run by women? What do you think about
that? Yeah, so that's a really good question. On the one hand, and what you're asking, Kenny, is really related to that history that I think is so fascinating, that the women who were in Nauvoo, who were in the meetings when Joseph Smith promised the priesthood and who are ordained to the highest and holiest order of priesthood, they believe very strongly that it was not just that the Relief Society was its only organization, should be run by women, but they felt it was a priesthood organization. They saw it as priesthood. And I think that would have helped, but I don't think it would have solved everything. Because you still had, even when the Relief Society was at its height of kind of having independence, you still had the idea that men were up here and, you know, women were somehow, they might have priesthood, but they were somehow lower. I do believe that you have to have men and women acting together in the councils of the church to have a real, not just equality, but I think more communitarian, where everybody has a voice. So I think it was good, but I don't think it answered all the problems. I think we've come to see other things in the last 100 and so years, right? What were you saying?
Thank you.
I think we have time for these two last questions, okay? Yeah, or comments.
We recently were involved with the ordination of a deacon, and the process, as we all know, is they have an interview and they get up in front and everyone votes for them to become a deacon. Mm-hmm. Whereas with the young women, they get up and they say, hey, this girl is now one of the young women's. How much of that difference in the process do you think contributes to this sense of hierarchy that then goes on through the years?
I think it totally reinforces in every single way the hierarchy and also the superiority of priesthood that gives that confidence I was talking about. So the good thing is, I mean, here's this boy who he's being acknowledged by the community as having priesthood and being special in some way. If girls had that same thing, where when they were 12, they received priesthood office and they had it, I think it would change their way of viewing themselves enormously. So, I mean, that's a great example, but I think there's just one after another of these examples where the boys are kind of reinforced their status and importance in the community, and the girls are sidelined. And I mean, even the missionary experience, I know a lot of women have really positive experiences on their missions, which can be, right? But again, they can't baptize their converts. And that difference is enormous in terms of how you are seen as whether or not you can mediate the power of God. And if you cannot perform the ordinances, then you are not seen to mediate the power of God, which is the essence of priesthood. And that is very damaging, I think. Let's one more.
you gave me so much to think about and really reminded me of good, and that's hard because yeah. there's also so much bad. And I would love to hear your wisdom on how you negotiate that nostalgia of the loss of the past and how you work that into your future.
Well, okay, so I mean...
Housekeeping.
Paul.
So, I mean, it's interesting that, I mean, yes, I can be nostalgic, but I don't underrate the damage, believe me. I do not. I mean, that's a whole nother talk, right? The damage it's done to me, to my husband, to others. And the damage of... You know, Paul was excommunicated in 1993. They waited for 7 years, but they finally tracked me down again. And I was excommunicated in 2000. But, you know, it's not just the act of excommunication, although that is much more damaging than you think it would be. Because I think there are 1,000 ways in which the negative aspects, you know, even in the best ward and stake, even with benevolent patriarchs, I mean, I had a father who was not at all... He was a very gentle person who was not at all going to give rules or anything. He was a wonderful father. But still, even in my home, the sort of difference of the of kind of what, how we saw my father versus how we saw my mother, it relates to that. And so, and mostly I'm not nostalgic. I mean, I was thinking of that in the Why We Stay. You know, I can think back of all the good things, but there were always... Intertwined with the good were these ways in which these negative aspects of priesthood, where hierarchy is emphasized, where women are marginalized, where, you know, we don't want to talk about LGBTQ issues, you know, all of these things, it is also in there, and there's suffering that goes on. And there's so much good that's done, but right along with the good is intertwined that those negative. So I don't think I forget that. I'm not too sentimental. But I feel sad sometimes. For me, it's more sad than nostalgic about, oh, and I at this point, I have no desire to be in the church. But it can work for people too. And I think that I see, you know, I see a lot of people that do a lot of good. There's a lot of good that happens. But there's a lot of pain, too. It's a real mixture. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you.